Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Penny Gore, for part two of tonight's BBC Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and online at bbc.co.uk/proms. And if you've been enjoying our extra high-quality audio stream on the website, you might like to know that it's now on offer for both live listening and catch-up, with all proms available for 7 days after broadcast in the same HD sound as the live broadcast. Next tonight, we'll hear the BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor Thomas Dausgaard continuing the prom's focus on Johannes Brahms, with a work that he was almost too anxious to write. In fact, Brahms was over 40 before he finally completed his first symphony. He was very conscious of being a late starter, or to be more precise, acutely aware of all the other symphonies against which his efforts would be measured. Beethoven in particular was something of a bugbear, as Brahms admitted to a friend, "You don't know what it's like always to hear that giant marching along behind me." Well, he'd been making efforts to get the thing over and done with for quite some time. As early as the 1860s, he'd put together part of the first movement, and some believe that he'd started even earlier than that, egged on by Clara Schumann. She had great faith in her friend's ability to produce a great piece, but Brahms was less confident, and even once he'd committed to the symphony in earnest, problems seemed to dog him all the way. The crises weren't entirely musical, though. The exact nature of his relationship with Clara has always been a matter for discussion and speculation, and in 1868, while Brahms was struggling with the symphony's finale, the two had a serious falling out over his high-handed attitude. Clara felt that he was trying to arrange her life, and she'd had quite enough of his moods too. Sharp letters were exchanged, and after a stunned silence, Brahms was the one to climb down. From Switzerland, where he was taking a holiday, he sent her a postcard with a musical phrase, an Alphorn tune, adding the verse, "High on the mountain, deep in the valley, I send you a thousand greetings." Well, eventually that phrase was to reappear in the finale of the First Symphony, although that wouldn't be for quite some time. Almost another decade went by before the symphony was performed, and there would be a great deal more constructive criticism along the way from Clara. At last, the premiere took place in Karlsruhe in November 1876. And after Brahms's mournful remark about Beethoven, it does rather seem that he was consciously emulating the great man in all the grandeur and sweep of his own symphony. The first movement opens with a long, slow introduction, so does the last. But in between, the authentic voice of Brahms shines through. Instead of a conventional slow movement and scherzo, there are two much shorter sections, more in the style of intermezzi, rather cleverly preparing the way for the powerful finale, with its chorale tune which appears, disappears, and then bursts forth in triumph in the very last moments of the work, as if to signal victory at long last. So a little buzz as the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the audience settle down for the final work in tonight's BBC Prom. And coming on stage, Thomas Dausgaard conducting the Symphony No. 1 by Brahms.
Thank you. Thank you.
A work in progress for many years, but so worth the wait. Brahms's Symphony No. 1, played tonight by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Thomas Dausgaard. And it's ironic that after finally managing to complete that work and finding that the critics were overwhelmingly positive, Brahms couldn't wait to move on to his second symphony. That followed on pretty quickly. Well, we've had all four of his symphonies at the Proms this year, a revival of a good old Proms tradition, and tonight's performance completes the cycle. And here's Thomas Dausgaard back on stage asking members of the orchestra to stand. Flautist Daniel Palethorpe, oboist David Powell, working his way around the woodwind section, the clarinets, the bassoons. The woodwind section playing such a role in this symphony. The horns and the leader, Stephen Bryant, his lovely melody in the second movement. Thomas Dausgaard soon to step down from his post as chief conductor of the Danish National Symphony Orchestra and take over as their conductor laureate, but he remains chief conductor of another highly regarded Scandinavian ensemble, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra. And he guest conducts all over the world, including frequent appearances with our own BBC performing groups. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back here on Friday, so they get a couple of days off for the eighth of their 12 proms this season, with Semyon Bychkov conducting them in Mahler's Symphony No. 6. Tomorrow, though, it's the London Symphony Orchestra. They'll be here with Valery Gergiev to play music by Prokofiev and Henri Dutilleux. That's at 7:30 tomorrow. But to continue tonight, including more music by Kevin Boland, time for me now to hand you back to the studio at Broadcasting House.
Penny, thank you very much indeed. That was Penny Gore with tonight's prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall. And you can hear that prom again on Thursday afternoon on Radio 3 at 2:30. Tomorrow afternoon, by the way, a second chance to hear the prom last night, Benjamin Britten and Colin Matthews, and the very last major work by Mozart, though not completed by him, his Requiem. That's at 2:30 tomorrow afternoon here on Radio 3. Well, now it's nearly a quarter to ten, and plenty more to come tonight on Radio 3. As Penny just mentioned there, if you heard Kevin Volans's brand new piano concerto given its world premiere at the Proms this evening, then why not hear what the man himself has to say about it and his other music? He's the subject of a composer portrait this evening. He's going to be in conversation with Tom Service at 10:00. Then at 11:15, the first of this week's essays explores the ambitions and also the idiosyncrasies of the music appreciation movement, as it called itself, in the early years of the 20th century. Richard Witts begins his profile tonight with a discussion on the work of one of the movement's pioneers, Percy Shoals. That's our essay tonight at 11:15. Then we're off to Cheltenham to hear music from this year's Jazz Festival. Among the performers in Jazz on 3 tonight, Django Bates. Jazz on 3 is at 11. Now, the Proms is home to both core repertoire, and it's an important window for many a contemporary composer, as we've heard tonight with Kevin Volans's world premiere. But for the past 13 years, the BBC has been encouraging not just established contemporary composers, but those on the very first rungs of the ladder with the BBC Inspire Young Composers scheme. It's a project that aims to bring together young composers so they can learn new skills and enjoy some music making together. And hundreds have enjoyed the chance to take part in one of the scheme's composer labs and then to enter the Young Composer Competition. And we've a chance now to hear one of those who came through that experience this year, highly commended for his efforts. We're going to hear a piece by Yuan Fan Yang, who began showing an interest in composing when he was just 7. Well, he's now studying composition at Cheetham School of Music in Manchester, and he's no stranger to the BBC. His music has already been broadcast a couple of times on BBC television. Well, this is a piece for solo piano called Waves. It was inspired by a painting by Emil Carlsson called Breaking Wave, and it's in three sections. The first is calm and quiet, the second undulates from small ripples into big waves, and then eventually rises to what amounts to a tsunami, and the third section depicts the scene after the wave has broken. Waves, composed by Yuan Fan Yang, is played here by John Reed and members of the Aurora Orchestra. Waves, a new composition by Huan Fan Yang, one of the composers in this year's BBC Proms Inspire scheme, played by members of the Aurora Orchestra. Well, on Thursday this week, the Royal Albert Hall will resound to the music of Handel when Glyndebourne Opera makes its annual pilgrimage to the Smoke, and this year with its new production of Handel's Rinaldo. The action gets underway on Thursday at 7 here on Radio 3. So let's hear some Handel now. Music to accompany the fireworks that would have wowed the crowds in Green Park in London in the April of 1749.
Thank you.
Music to accompany the royal fireworks that celebrated the signing of the peace treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle in the late 1740s. Handel's overture to his orchestral suite was played there by the English concert directed by Trevor Pinnock. And plenty more from Handel at the BBC Proms this week, as I say. Glyndebourne Festival Opera will be in residence from 7 o'clock on Thursday night and live here on Radio 3 with their new production of Rinaldo. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, and we're going to stay at the Proms now. It's 10 o'clock, and here's Tom Service to introduce tonight's composer portrait.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall in the Royal College of Music for this Proms Plus portrait, featuring the music and the person of the Irish composer who was born and brought up in South Africa, Kevin Volans. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music are going to play three of Kevin's pieces, the 10th String Quartet, a work called A Thousand Bars, which is both a trio and a quartet. I promise that'll make sense later. We start, though, with a piece whose sheer power and volume speaks for itself, Asanga for solo percussion. Now, Asanga is a Sanskrit word that means freedom from attachment, and Kevin Volans wrote the piece in 1997. So here, please welcome now on stage at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music, to play with considerable freedom, no doubt, Kevin Volans' Asanga, percussionist Barnaby Archer.
Thank you.
Barnaby Archer playing Kevin Volan's Sanger here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Kevin Volan's, you said, I said that piece spoke for itself, and it does, and the sheer energy and power, especially of Barnaby's performance, but you say in a rather gnomic programme note about it that you wrote that piece without any concept or technique in mind. But, I mean, you must have had something, surely, with the sheer focus and ferocity of what we've just heard. That surely isn't... Surely you had an idea that that's what you wanted to do with this.
No, I never have an idea of what I'm going to do. I've spent the last 30 years trying to work on a sort of anti-conceptual method of composition where you just start and let the logic of the piece dictate... Each bar dictates the next one, and so on. So it's really just contrasting different kinds of patterning. I did have in mind the fact it's called a Sanger, Freedom from Attachment. I wrote it for my friend, Robin Shulkovsky, who had lost her father. And she and I believe very much in the sort of healing power of drums and drumming. And I thought if I wrote her a difficult piece and she spent hours practicing, it would help. And she said it did, so that was the idea.
But Kevin, that whole sense of starting literally then from a blank piece of manuscript paper, but a blank idea in that way, I mean, where does that come from? Because it goes against a lot of the people you trained with. I'm thinking particularly of Karlheinz Stockhausen, whose assistant you were in the 1970s. This idea of not planning seems to go against what he was all about.
I know the whole school of serialism was based on pre-planning, rather like architecture. I studied architecture as well, and I loved the idea of planning a large piece, like planning a skyscraper, with down to the last detail before you start building. But it didn't work for me at all as a method. And also, I mean, I was very influenced in the 70s. By African textiles that have an unpredictability about them that can't really be pre-planned. And I also then made a series of recording trips of African music and found myself teaching, on one hand, serial technique to the Stockhausen class and being in love with this completely different world. And African music is generally... It's not non-conceptual, but it is kind of anti-conceptual. And that, I think the right word is existential. So I wanted to find a kind of existential way of composing that you were in the moment and you start with the first bar and you stay in the moment and let the piece grow out of that rather than planning in advance.
There's quite a dichotomy there, though, isn't there? I mean, it's one of the things, even you asked to be introduced as an Irish composer who was born in South Africa, but in a way that difference between an African perspective and a European perspective, I think it seems from reading your biography, going to work with Stockhausen in the 1970s and then writing those famous string quartets of what became string quartets, White Man Sleeps or Hunting Gathering, that in a way... You had to be in Europe to discover you were African, whereas when you talk about playing the piano growing up in South Africa, you thought of yourself as European.
Oh, no, absolutely. That whole thing of you growing up in Africa and thinking of yourself as... We were called Europeans, you know. I mean, that was the official name.
You know, as a white South African, you were called
Europeans only. It was only later became whites only. I mean, it's so bizarre. And as soon as I got to Germany, I realized I was not European. And then I went back to South Africa and thought, I'm not African either. So you certainly by the late 70s, I had a kind of identity crisis from that point of view. But then by the mid 80s, having worked through that, you realize that your identity lies in the work, really, in your own composition in a way. I mean, you don't need a nationality, as it were.
No, okay, but you probably need, I mean, you need models or you need inspirations from somewhere. I think you've said somewhere that you can escape your cultural upbringing, but you can't escape your environment, what's around you. So what were the things that you took from the environments, whether you're thinking about walking along the street in South Africa or in Cologne or wherever, that became part of your music?
Well, the huge difference, I mean, between Cologne and South Africa is space and time, not just space, but time as well. Everything in the 70s in Germany was compartmentalized into little pieces of time. You could go to this office from 10 to 12 in the morning or 1 to 3 on Wednesday afternoons and so on. And I was so used to living in a sort of an infinite environment where not only space, but time feels infinite.
In Africa, you mean?
In Africa. So I felt when I did the first pieces, which were soundscape pieces of the African bushveld and insects, and so which is the
these were literal field recordings of the sounds.
I made live recordings, yeah, and made a big piece which we presented at the ICA in 1981. And I felt we evolved as a species in that sound environment, which has not changed for millions of years. And I felt that the sense of space and tranquility that those sounds carry with them, and a sense of time which in the West we have completely lost.
But then you've got a problem, you see, because if you're writing pieces, I mean, whether you like it or not, you're writing string quartets, you're writing orchestral pieces or chamber works, even the percussion piece we just heard, which does, after all, have a time, lasted about 8 minutes or so. It's being programmed here. We're not, alas, this is a very nice space, but it's not infinite, this concert hall. So, I mean, aren't you already working with a sort of contradiction there about actually having to write? I mean, your pieces of music inevitably are compartments of time, like German offices.
You're very politely avoiding the word compromise. It is, of course, I started by writing open-ended pieces, which have no given duration, and you can play it for as long as you like. But the whole West, I mean, the minute you walk on stage and present any kind of music on stage, it becomes concert music. Even if you take traditional African music and put it on stage, and there's an expectation, because everyone's sitting there in rows, I mean, they've got to go home. They want to get out. I mean, they're trapped, so to speak. So there are limits, time limits. But I mean, I'm still fighting against, because every new commission, particularly if it's an orchestral one, you say, "Oh, goody, can I write 45 minutes?" And they say, "No, no, between 20 and 30, preferably 25, because that can be easily programmed."
Now, look, the next piece we're going to hear leads on very precisely from what you're just saying, because after all, it's called 1,000 Bars. I mean, what could be more about measuring spaces or times of music? 1,000 bars of music, presumably. Is that what happens?
It is 1,000 bars, but it's a very tiny. There's only one event per bar. I very rarely write short pieces like this, 8 minutes. But when you get the opportunity, they're very good as opportunities to experiment a bit, so to speak, and they become etudes of composition. And the 1,000 bars, in a way, goes back to long conversations I had with Morton Feldman about getting over the bar line. And I decided to put one event per bar, just one note or one chord, so that their idea of you can't get across the bar line, so to speak. So it's a kind of an intro, and it's a relentless a sort of succession of 1,000 events.
And each bar is very short. It's only one fast crotchet.
It's only one note, yeah.
In each bar. So there's a sort of obsessive quality to this music. It's also completely different from a sangha. It's also very quiet.
Oh, it's the opposite. It's almost inaudible, yeah. But well, we chose these pieces for contrast. Because it's a small piece, you can do things like that, and that's what becomes interesting for the composer. Mm. So they're pieces about composition rather than about concerts, if you see what I mean.
Okay, well, what you wanted to say to the people in the hall and the people listening then, if this is a piece that only composers can understand?
No, that's like
something the Germans would say in the 1970s.
It's a way for people to get into the world of composition.
Very beautifully put. Nicely avoided, too. Let's hear, then, Kevin Volans' 1,000 Bars. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, Francesca Barrett on violin, the cellist Romain Deno, and the two pianists on one piano, Matthew Fletcher and Gregory Dorrit. 1,000 Bars. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Volland's 1,000 Bars, exactly 1,000 Bars. I hope you were counting at home, just as we were here. Musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, Francesca Barrett, Roman Dino, Matthew Fletcher, and Gregory Drott. Kevin, I'm getting the impression you like musical extremes. the reason I say that, of course, is based on what the difference between the two pieces we've just heard. Very fast, very violent music, obsessive, small, machine-like, quiet music.
Yeah, well, they're the two most extremes that I've written, but I like music that takes risks, and it's one of the things that I was so pleased with the commission for the Liszt bicentenary was that Liszt was a composer.
Your piano concerto.
The piano concerto from this evening. That Liszt was a composer who was not afraid of taking risks, and not afraid of making big mistakes as well. And for me, he was the father of modernism, the first composer to experiment with if you define modernism as nothing is given and you look at things a priori without any preconception, he's the first composer I know of who worked with synthetic scales, with whole tone scales, with atonality, with 12-tone rows. I mean, he was really... in a sense, ahead of the game. And he's a composer who later on wrote pieces that were about composition. In big contrast to somebody like Brahms, who always produced great work but destroyed anything that might not, all his early work, so that, you know, nobody could think that he had any flaws.
All right, so you're an heir to Liszt then?
Oh, yeah, no, I love, yes.
But does that mean, all right, well, what mistakes have you made then? If you say Liszt made a lot of mistakes and also let them out there, what mistakes have you made?
I'm not going to mention them in public. Big one. But I mean, this is a risky thing to do, really.
1,000 Bars, that piece.
1,000 Bars, and very quiet, and there is a very well-considered sort of development in the piece, but... it may not be apparent, and it's also so quiet that you might not have heard that they were not playing the same thing all the way through. and also the reason for two pianists is because of the extreme difficulty of playing that softly. I divided the piano part between two people to make it more playable.
All right, but where then does the intuition then come in your music? I mean, because if you think about Liszt as a model of somebody who's looking for extremes, who's unafraid of going places that music hadn't gone before, your music on the surface at least doesn't sound like Liszt. So is there other composers or people you go to, you think of, who in more recent times maybe have got that intuition thing right?
I think intuition is the wrong word, and I think we should also be clear that these are aspirations rather than things think I've achieved. They're things I would like to achieve. I mean, there is no such thing as a conceptual composition, and there's no such thing as a sangha, freedom from attachment. If you reach that stage, you are enlightened and you really don't have to bother about writing another piece. There is a kind of a private dialogue that goes on with composers all the time, and I think somebody like Liszt makes that clear. I mean, I very strongly believe that music is not upmarket entertainment, classical music. I mean, it's a philosophy, and it's a growing philosophy and a growing kind of conversation that goes on between composers, and it's as much about composition as it is about coming up with a final product that people are going to listen to, if you know what I mean. There's two sides to it, a private and a public side. And with these more experimental pieces, you are revealing more the private side, so to speak. It's difficult with a big public event to take the same degree of risks. I could have done this with the piano concerto and had the piano just going bloop, bloop, bloop for 20 minutes while the orchestra played inaudibly, but I don't think I would have been invited back. So it's a balance, which is a compromise between you choose to what you think is appropriate for the moment. I mean, so with chamber music, with a short piece, you can be wilder than you would ever be in a very public kind of event.
Now, fittingly, the last piece we're going to hear tonight, Kevin Volans' 10th string quartet, in a way puts the two extremes of the worlds we've heard in the first two pieces this evening together, with the fast violent music and still music as well in the 10th string quartet, Kevin.
Yes, it's mainly fast and violent here. I have to say that it is, at the moment, it is the 10th string quartet. It was two movements. The second movement was a disaster. So it's now only one movement, but I'm sure it will be two movements at a later date. I am the bane of my publishers' lives because I keep rewriting pieces and they keep changing names and lengths and everything. But at the moment, this is the 10th quartet.
Again, in your very short program, right, there is a personal, there seems a very deeply personal inspiration to behind this piece.
Well, there was, and that not so much an inspiration, but I was busy with the first movement and got almost to the end, and my brother died. And then the second movement was a disaster, and it was simply because I was all over the place. So that's why I had to scrap it in the end, you know. But again, this is part to do with every decade I've tried I've tried to overcome notions about form, firstly notions of style, then notions of form, then notions of what is composition. And in the 2000s, I decided to get rid of the notion of content. So I wrote some very empty pieces, but the opposite. This is the opposite. One way of getting rid of content is put so much material into the piece that you can't hear anything clearly.
Okay,
so it becomes a barrage of sound.
Right,
and
so
this was
a very
my
dense piece,
experiment
then, yeah.
In that direction. Yeah.
Where is that philosophy going to take you in the future?
I have no idea.
Really, none?
None at all, really.
Where do you hope it will take? I mean, do you hope that you will get to that state of pure Asanga-like enlightenment? I mean, is that actually what you're striving for as a composer?
Well, I think that would be great, yes, but I would definitely give up at that point. But I have to say this is not just frivolous in the sense that there are good reasons for it. And I felt that so much music of the 20th century has become a victim of its own concepts. And that included Stockhausen himself, who was such a master of combining imagination with concept and with technique to begin with. But later on, he became a victim of his own technique and his own craftsmanship. So this is all an attempt to go beyond craftsmanship, because I think a new art lies in that realm beyond your own knowledge. And therefore, you can't use what you already know, so you have to explore unknown areas.
As we're going to hear now, in the 10th string quartet, music full of content and yet empty and yet full. The Artesian String Quartet, musicians from the Royal Academy of Music playing Kevin Volans' 10th string quartet. Thank you.